Now, my next guest this Saturday morning is doctor and poet Glenn Cahoon. He's been writing poetry since the 1990s and is a youth doctor in the Horowhenua district. In 2004, he was awarded the Prize in Modern Letters, which was the country's largest literary award at the time. And having started up his own imprint, Old King Press, a few years ago, Dr. Cahoon is now releasing two, not one, but two new books of poetry, both of which are examinations of the oral poem in New Zealand. Ngā Wahine I Toru, Three Women, is a collection of Māori poetic forms, while Myths and Legends of the Ancient Pākehā is an exploration of the sung poem in English, written as a response to Ngā Wahine I Toru. And Glenn is with us in the Wellington studio. Morena.
Kia ora. How are you going, Susie?
I'm going very well, thank you. But it's not just you. Tell me what you've brought in with you, which is sitting on the desk in front of us.
I've brought in what I call my totems. They're foot-high wooden dolls, for lack of a better word, that are, that over the years I've painted or have had friends paint as well, up as different characters from New Zealand history. And I wanted to get, I suppose, the poem out of the book and make the point that these are oral poems and sung forms. So I stick the poem inside the doll and then, or the totem, and often when I go around talking to audiences, people choose the totem that they're most drawn towards, and I tell them their story and sing them their song, or recite their oral poem.
We might do that a little bit later on.
Sure.
But I just thought it's quite striking looking over the desk to you, because I can't help but see them as well. And for you, I think it's so interesting that it's you've published the books, but in a way, it's not really about the books, is it?
No. As I say, the poems are like powdered soup, you know. You've got to add some water to it to make the poem. The final form of the poem in an oral poem is, of course, the declaimed form, the chanted form, the sung form. And there's so many things that happen when it's sung or chanted, and it's different every time it's published. And, Robbie Burns is a great example of that. And which you'll know lots about, and certainly was one of the models when I was exploring the whole field. Mm.
Yes, he was very keen on songs and poems and recitation and performance. And I suppose, is this something that's having a bit of a renaissance, do you think? You know, slam poetry, which I suppose has become much more popular in recent years. I'm not necessarily saying that that's your thing. I suspect
that's
it's not. Is it your thing, or is it not your thing?
I love it.
It's so ironic, because about the time I was looping out into sung poetry, for me, the models that took me that way were Māori sung forms. You know, I'd gone to Te Tī nearly 30 years ago now. 30 years ago, yeah. Mm. And listened to Māori singing poetry from that point. And that's what drew me and looped me out. And I've worked on, Three Women, Ngā Wahine e Toru, for 20 years or so. Mm. But in that time, slam poetry's come, and spoken word poetry and rap and hip-hop. And so I think it's great to come back round and meet it. I went the other way. I went back and then came back round forward.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I work with young people, so they're not listening to old man's poems. They're listening to doof, 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 which is awesome. And my daughter, I love it. But I've just gone the back way.
Yeah, but sometimes I guess the road less travelled is the better experience. Would you say?
Well, it's just the way I stumbled into it. I would have, no, Susie, I would have loved to be a hip-hop rap star, man. Yeah.
That could be in your future.
Give me the bling, man. Give me the bling. I was just like, why did I do this? It was like, oh, man, young people have beaten me again. Yeah.
What drew you to, as you're saying, that experience of the oral recitation to that form of Māori poem?
Mō teatea, really. Listening to Māori sing Mō teatea. Going to Te Tiriti as a young man, working in the marae, doing dishes all day, making fried bread, going into the whare at night. Up there, people, you know, you can be welcomed onto the marae 24/7. So 3 o'clock in the morning, people would come up to farewell somebody laying in state on the marae. You'd be woken up with a small porphyry. And then this old guy or this old queer would shuffle forward and sing literally to the dead. And not in a polished way like you might get in Te Matatini or a Gun Kapahaka group, but just with an old cracked voice. You know, they would have worked the shift before, driven up at night. And I just remember so many experiences of waking up at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning to somebody singing something. And it was the poet in me listened, and it was like, oh my God, what are they singing? And it wasn't, you know, because I couldn't access the words because my understanding of te reo wasn't that great then, and not that it's that great now, but man, there was something incredibly powerful about the sound and the sound quality, and it just drew me in, and really I just started learning and exploring and talking to people from that point forward. Got a collection of, you know, George Gray's Ngā Mō Teatea, translated by Apirana Ngata, and Pei Te Hurenui Jones, and looked through those, and then I could access what was being said in English as well. And it was like, heck, I've done a BA in English. I'm already an established poet. Nobody told me about this canon of poetry. And I'm like, even now, I hardly ever, I've never been to a festival and seen Māori poetry showcased, you know? Even my daughter, when she's in Kapahaka, you know, who's growing up going to kura, it's like, baby, these are poems. Oh, Dad, you know, it's, I hear some Māori talk about them as poetry, but it's always we few, you know? Often it's seen as cultural performance or, but the literature, what's being said, and it's an extant tradition. It's not, it is old, but it's also entirely modern and being written in all the time. You know, as the Wellington women's rugby team has demonstrated to us all, you know, you can have a crack even in the here and now. And I'm just like, yeah, I just wanted to, I thought as a New Zealand poet, it behoves me to be able to have some understanding of this form. And that then took me back, as Māori have always done, to my own culture and said, well, how do I access the power of a sung poem? Because when you perform a haka or sing a mō teatea, it's more powerful than me reading a poem. And then I realised we had our own sung forms. We have our own sung forms.
What do you see as being the for you, the most powerful sung forms of the poems from your background?
In English, you mean? Yeah. I don't think there's any one. I think it just depends what mood you're in, what energy you're in. Like, sometimes a sea shanty's great, you know? Jackie, thank you, Jackie, please. Kissed a girl and made her sneeze. Didn't he shake the Sheila's knees? In the arfy tears squeeze. Hey-ho, hey-ho, how the wind blows. hey ho, hey ho, over fovo. Or I'm with a kid, clip clop, clip clop. Can you see them? Do you not? Stitch hop, turn pop. Fantails in my mutton chop. Flap, flap, what's that? Kaka pool beneath my hat. Smokes, hope, bar of soap. Two white rats inside my coat. So the nursery rhyme, you know, for Barney White Rats, the old swagman. Jackie Price, a sealer from Southland, who was marooned out on the Solander Islands and escaped in a coracle. Yeah, so it depends what mood. Or... you know, even love bellatry, you know. Elizabeth, Elizabeth, what whisper rises in the spit of rain against the oak and barn, their wild iron, our banging heart. A love song from Tom to Elizabeth from Dennis Glover's poem, The Magpies, you know. So there's so many different energies. And then with the totems, you know, I've got about 30 of these little guys sitting around the house and all their, depends what mood they're in. It's just like I'm, you know, haunted all the time and have all these little people speaking and singing. So I think there's many different forms. Yeah, and even now, like I say, there's you can access spoken word, rap, hip-hop.
Just talking about sea shanties puts me in mind of The Wellerman, which was so popular a couple of years ago. What did you make of that? It kind of had this
fantastic,
huge moment.
Fantastic, yeah. And I can understand it. And, yeah, I guess I've been working in those forms for a while before that, and the Wellerman was one of the shanties I remember listening to and exploring and taking apart, seeing how it worked and using as a model. So it was great, and one of the reasons I wrote the poems in English too, as because I wrote the book Ngā Wahine e Toru, Three Women. I wrote that. And then in some ways, I thought I wanted a response to that. That's why I published the books together and designed them
together. They're sort of companions, essentially.
Yeah, it's like a volume one and a volume two, really. Yeah. And I think Myths and Legends of the Ancient Pākehā is a response to Ngā Wahine e Toru. And I thought of them as songs I could bring onto the marae, because, you know, I'd been to so many marae and I started off singing Elvis, you know, because I had no other songs.
You talk about it as being Elvis Presley's fault.
Love me tender, love me true. You know, I was like, oh my God, I've got no other songs.
This is a bit of I think this is a thing for Pākehā. I have been in a similar situation on a marae and I sang Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
Because what, you know, I was like, oh, do I have a song?
Yeah.
Is, you know, what, also, you know, what is the appropriateness or otherwise in singing an old Scottish folk song?
Yeah.
When in Aotearoa on a marae. So I went for
That would be beautiful,
Judy Garland,
though,
anyway.
Old Scottish folk song. Go for that every time.
Well, maybe next time.
Nothing wrong with
time.
Judy Garland, though.
No, maybe next time, you know. But I thought it was interesting that you talked about Elvis Presley as being, you know, it was his fault because that was the song that you had.
Yeah, I felt bereft.
Yeah.
You know, I felt bereft. It was hard enough just singing. As I say, Māori have taught me to sing. Not that they would take any credit for that. But, you know, those old women, I went to them for their songs to start with after Elvis and would sing songs that came from Te Tī where I stayed and have been back to for many years since. But they were like, as Auntie Rongo would say, well, sing me your songs. I'm interested to know where your mum and dad come from. What are they interested, you know? And don't sing my songs. I sing them better than you. And so these, you know, I did. It's taken me the rest of my life to come up with the songs that I can take to marae, and there a song needs to be tuned to lots of different energies depending on if everyone's sad, it needs to be funny. If everyone's laughing, it needs to be sad. And so you need to, have a little portable hymn book. But these are songs for me to take to the marae, I think, and it's time, well past time, Pākehā sung to Māori.
Mm.
There's a vulnerability in it. Often we bring them our solutions, what we think are solutions. It's like, this has to be our tellings. We bring tellings off and tellings how it's going to be and power structures. And we have never come and sung. There's something disarming, disrobing about singing. Singing's not a solution, but sometimes a better answer to a better question.
And you have published the books, which are beautiful, but also you have created soundtracks, which...
I have, yeah.
How do you see them? Are they companion pieces? Would you hope that people would listen to them rather than read the books, or read the books alongside them?
No, the soundtracks are the real deal. Mm. That's where the money is. Yeah, and they're on my website, and they don't cost anything. You know, you can just go and listen to them. That's the real poem, and they're sung by lots of different New Zealand artists. Or sometimes by people in a pub, or, you know, by nephews and nieces, everyday singers. The books give you access to the words, you know, the scores for some of them, some of the notes around it. And
yes.
Myths and Legends got fantastic illustrations by Nigel Brown too, who just captures the characters so well and makes them come alive.
Because that must have been a huge undertaking.
It was nuts, completely nuts. You know, it's like so many times it's like, why am I doing this? You know, but you know, that's, poets don't think of that. Poets are just, you know, you get an idea and you keep scratching at it, really.
It brings it to life in a very different way, rather than someone reading, you know, internally reading the book on their own.
Yes, I think so.
It's a very different energy when
That's
you're then
I
performing
found.
Something, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, these are my accidental explorations. I'm no expert in folk music or oral poems of either tradition. These are my musings. But it brings it alive in a completely different way, and it made me look at the poem again and realise that, like, for tens of thousands of years, the poem was sung. It was a sung form. And it was only a technology a couple of thousand years ago with writing that caused them to be written down. And that may, when you write a poem down, it becomes more cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
You read the poem again, you can study the poem. And poems increasingly started to have more of the conceit in them, the coiled idea, which is beautiful. That's how I came to poetry, the code, the unsaid said, you know. But it also made them brainy and remote and academic increasingly, and we forgot the two prime urges, the cry and the itch, the cry and the itch. And this is why we utter, why we speak. Am I alone? If that's in the... And it reminded me that's where the poem came from, not from being clever. And that cadence, human voice, carries so much of the meaning of the poem. So I overwrote a lot of these poems, and then when I started to sing them, it's like, well, that's too complex. Because you didn't need so much colour, because the colour's in the singing.
Where did you get the tunes from?
Yeah, I think in English, I think just, I don't know, man, just ads off TV, and I'm still terrified that people say, hey, that's from there or that's from there. A couple of, I purposely chose tunes that I knew, but most of them I just, you know, I grew up listening to hymns. I listened to lots of sea shanties, and I think Yeah, music is all around us. It's going back and accessing tunes, which are, and they're very simple tunes. In the poems in Three Women, I worked with Kuia and Ko Matua, who, you know, writing rangi is second nature to them. And I would make attempts and they would make them better. Yeah. So that, you know, that was it. And then the people who sung and recorded the poems, they, of course, changed them again and developed them. So, again, it's the beauty of the oral poem is it keeps being changed by everyone who sings it. Mm. So,
you're listening to RNZ National's Saturday Morning with Susie Ferguson. My guest is doctor and poet Glenn Cahoon. We actually haven't talked about any of the doctoring yet. We'll maybe get on to that. But it would be great to hear some of the soundtrack. I think we've got Ko Te Rohe, which we can hear. Tell us a little bit about this one.
So this is from He Mō Te Te Ki Tōku Whaia. Or Ki Tētahi Whaia, Songs for a Mother, and they're written to my mum about, my mum's always loved her garden, so they're all written to her favourite plants, and one of them was the rose. And I worked with Ani Black, who is a distinguished kuia of Ngāi Tūhoe, Whirimako Black's mum. I worked with Whirimako and her sister Rangi Tūno as well. But it was just, it was one of the most magical moments of the whole project, because we'd been working away recording the poems and trying rangi out for size, and then someone just said, I think it was Whiri or Rangi Tūno, said, Mum, just do this one, do it as a apakura, you know, a song, a lament. And so Ani picked it up, and you know, she taught me more in that 5 minutes, you know, than just about anybody else, because she picked it up. So, you know, she hadn't really read it before much. She'd helped me with the translation. She picked it up and she just did this, you know, and it's like she read the words like sheet music. That's what I noticed. And she was really particular about macrons, like she would growl us all the time. Drag that. There's a macron. There's no macron on that. Don't drag that. There's a, even her daughter, you know, out, one of the best voices in the country. And it's like she was particular, and she accessed this old sound, and it's all that ever drew me to Mō Te Atea. So, and Ani died a year, 2 years ago. So to have captured this was a real gift. Yeah.
Let's hear it. This is Ko Te Rohe, and Ani Black is the singer.
Ko Te Rohe. No te hari, no te wero, no te koingo, no te kwai. Ngā rohi a tōku whae a i pua wai. He whero pēnei tonu i te toto. Kaore ia i rongo i te kōrero. Whakatau mō te rohi. Arai ki te a e ngā atua he ture hau. Kua mate i te ngahere. I hoatu e tētahi tōna atanga. I hoatu e tētahi tōna tia re kakara ipuhia e te tahi te ha whakaora na ara tau mahi ka hua mai te puti puti kei te marama ke tōku whaia tino marama ana ia e.
That is Ko Te Rohi, Annie Black, the performer. All the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up, Glenn.
Yeah, she's great, you know, and like I say, she did that in one take.
Mm.
No scanning out a melody. But Annie wasn't... What I loved about working with Annie is that she loved English poetry. She taught English poetry. She was a teacher. We could talk about English poetry or poetry in English, and we could talk about Māori poetry. And she was so generous with her knowledge and just being able to sit beside her and run my translations past her and see how she took them and what she would correct, what she would leave, how she would say this could be said this way. And just watching her work, you know, it was just a real, real privilege, to be honest.
Because in the book, you do, in Ngāwahine e Toru, you do have English, would you call them translations?
Yeah.
English versions of the poems.
Yeah, I mean...
How do you work that?
Well, you know, I always loved Ngā Mō Teatea, that collection of poems I talked about earlier, how our poetry sat together.
Mm.
Because of all our arts, I think our poetry have remained the most separate. Visual artists, musicians have been working in each other's forms for a long time. But in poetry, I guess it's the access to both languages has limited it.
Mm.
But to see both poems beside each other. So I started in English, translated into Te Reo, three times, because each time I wanted to loosen the translation so that it sung more in Te Reo rather than become just a literal translation.
Mm.
So the poems kind of become separate poems. They're not, I call them equivalent poems.
Mm.
And then I ran them past first language speakers to make sure they were sweet in Te Reo and not flat, and that I hadn't. Yeah, which meant putting some poetry back into them after that process.
Mm-hmm.
But that took me a year. You know, that's 20 years of going back over them time and time again. The loveliest thing is I started writing them when Libby was hapū with Oriwa, my daughter, Olive, and thinking there's a section of Ori Ori, which are songs written to children, and I thought I would sing them to her as a child, but now she's turning 21 this year. But she helped me with the third lot of translations. I would run them by her because she'd been to kura her whole life, and her Te Reo Māori is much better than mine, and she would say, "Yeah, Dad, that works," or "No, Dad, I would say it this way," and that was a lovely experience. Yeah. Being corrected by my child over and over again.
That's the thing, you know, you can still sing it to your child, it's just your child's grown up now.
I can, she won't let me rock her though. Yeah, I think the song's more for me now than for her, but that's all right.
We do have a recording of The Rose, which is the companion poem, I guess, to Ko Te Rohi, which I think we can hear now to give people a bit of a flavour of it.
From joy, from fear, from ache, from cheer, my mother's roses bloom blood red. She does not know how Chloris found a dead nymph in the forest. who lent beauty, who lent scent, that a zephyr gently blew until a flower sweetly grew. There is no need. There is no need.
So that's a recording of you. Yes. How do you say you're performing it, you're reading it, you're reciting it?
No, I'm reading.
You're reading it?
Yep, I'm reading that poem. Mm. And like, I do love the written poem.
Mm.
Yeah, and I've come back to the written poem. It's just nice to have both options up my sleeve. And, and I think the written poem is, I think of it now as a song for the spoken voice.
Mm.
And it has different pleasures. But, when I'm with an audience and I can see their eyes glazing over, it's like, why did my wife bring me to this poetry reading? You know, you owe me big time for this. It's like I can pull on something that grabs him by the scruff of the neck a bit more.
Mm.
And I think oral poetry in that sense, just like rap, hip-hop, spoken word, is more generous to an audience. And it accesses, the cry and the itch inside us better, I think.
Mm-hmm. I've been looking at the totems, which are on the desk the whole way through, and I'm still quite torn between two of them, which is quite difficult. There are six of them. I don't know which one to plump for, because I feel a little bit like this one in the black. I do like the flowers at the bottom.
This one here?
Yeah, this one. But yeah. I think I'm actually going to plump for the red one.
The red one? Yeah.
How would you describe this totem that I have picked?
You've picked my ex-partner, Libby. Yeah, so I hope you're not listening, Libby.
Kia ora, Libby.
She'll tell you the truth. She'll be ringing up.
We'll get her on later.
No. And there's a section of poems I've written to her. Mm-hmm. Ngā wahine e toru, the three women that I write to are my daughter, Libby, her mum, my ex-partner, and my mum. And so this is Libby.
Mm.
And
what does it say? I can't read the Ranginui.
Ranginui on one side and
Papatuanuku
on the other side. And there's a poem from her that I've written to her called Ranginui Rawa ko Papatuanuku that likens us to those old lovers in the beginning. But I'll sing you another one called Te Tangi a Te Kōtuku. And that's from her her group of poems.
Mm.
And, yeah, it goes like this. Ka tangi a tūngā ko tuku i te pō. Hau wini wini, hau wana wana. Hau wini wini, hau wana wana. Anō nei kua hoki, maharahara mahira. Ōku whakaro, aroha, kua naku naku. He taurapa, he tauihu, he hoipō tere tere. Ngā toinga waka, e pai ana ki uta. Mā wai e whakapiripiri, ka kōpā ahi aku ringa, nā puritia, nā puritia e. Like the voices of Kōtoku, calling to each other in the middle of the night. Over the sound of bad weather, rising wind, falling rain, malevolent calm, the memories of love drift back to me in pieces. Stern post, bow, paddle, fragments of a boat wrecked at sea. Who will bind them together? How long will I stand here, my hands growing numb from holding on?
That's really beautiful.
But we're okay now. Geez, well rid of me.
Why did you choose women? Why did you choose those three women?
I think mainly because of Olive, because I thought it would... Libby was hapu. She was pregnant with Olive when I started. Mm. And I wanted to write Ori Ori for my daughter, who would grow up Māori and Pākehā. And also, I'm sure Libby won't mind me saying this too. Libby and I, you know, when I started to write the poems for Libby, we were really in that space where we didn't know if we would be together or not. And you know, so much Māori poetry is the blues, you know, and sad-ass love poetry is and lament is at the heart of Māori poetry. And so as I wrote those, I really was in the valley of, I never knew whether they would have a happy ending or not.
Mm.
So that ambiguity, I think, was perfect space. And I think of all the poems in Three Women, it's the poems I wrote to Libby that best access, I think, the way Māori, a Māori sensibility. Because sometimes I see myself lapsing into Pākehā ways of thinking when I'm writing the poems.
Mm.
And it's like, that ended up being Pākehā and kind of in its deep structure.
Mm.
But the poems for Libby, sort of, I think the fact that they were written in the heat of battle, I think, kept them there. But yeah.
I know this is something that you have written about in the books. Do you wrestle with cultural appropriation around this?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, I don't think you can live in a modern New Zealand without thinking about that as a Pākehā. And I've written quite an extensive bit on that in the beginning of the book as an introduction, because I knew that people would ask the question. And, yeah, it's about threading the needle, isn't it, really? I think I made a decision to just write in... sing my own stories, so all the stories of my daughter, so that they're not other people's stories, they're my stories. And I made sure to surround myself with people who are experts in te reo and expert in these art forms. And you know, I've maintained a relationship in the Māori world up north for 30 years. And I know deep in my own heart that they come out of a poet's love for poetry and also a desire to go back to my own world, my Pākehā world, and say, we also sang. Why aren't we singing? And also, why aren't we talking about Māori poetry? You know, why are we not doing this? Because there are so many enormously qualified people to talk about that. Why aren't they talking at poetry festivals? Why aren't we teaching examples of Māori poetry in schools? Because you can teach allusion, metaphor, rhythmic use of language brilliantly by accessing Māori poetry. You also have all over the place, all through the country, marae not far from your school with songs sung about your local region. Go to them. Bring those kui and kaumātua in. Construct a unit about the song sung about that hill, that mountain, you know, that forest. But at the end of the day, I think, too, everything we do in art is also an appropriation. And, you know, is it appropriation? Is it just as a New Zealander now that I, and now that Māori have been powerful in my life, and in some ways I've been enculturated by them. And I've learnt so much in medicine as well as poetry from Māori. So I think it comes from an authentic response to the Māori world rather than me going and pinching. And also the work is not for sale in that sense. The oral, the sung forms are all free and downloadable or streamable. And, you know, I managed to get everyone who worked on it paid. I didn't take their work for granted. So I don't know. I tried to commit as little sin as possible, but, you know, a little bit of sin in poetry and music. Who, you know, haiku is an appropriation. The sonnet is an appropriation from those poor Italians, you know. And, yeah, so I don't know. I walk gently upon the earth. And also my daughter would tell me, you know, she's a kura kid. Believe me, if I can get it past my daughter, you know, those young kids from kura, they know their stories, they know their history, they know.
We haven't really had time to talk very much about your other career as a doctor. But a lot of people will be aware of your writing. You wrote a piece recently for The Listener, for example, because with the new government, well, I don't know if they're a new government anymore, with the government, I have to stop saying new, I suppose, things feel different for you, certainly, with the experience that you are having. And you wrote a really interesting piece in The Listener, which was sort of in the form of a letter to David Seymour. Why did you write that, and what is at the root of what you were wanting to achieve?
I guess it grew out of the fact that David has whakapapa tutati, you know, and that's the place I've gone for 30 years, and there's a bunch of people up there I know really well, and have loved, and I know that I've been loved by some of them, and I also know from talking to the people up there that it's not a place that he's been back to hardly ever, and it's not a set of relationship he's invested time in building up. And I just think if he did that, it would be great. Because the relationship between the cultures, in my experience, you can't really legislate it. You have to kind of have relationships with each other and fall in love with each other. And I think lots of New Zealanders just get on and do that, and have authentic relationship. And then we're careful and tender how we say things. And I want him to be careful and tender how he says things. You can have your thoughts, but have some understanding how another body of people is going to receive that. And it makes me sad that we're undoing some things that we've done well in the past and at risk of undoing. And it makes me even sadder that politics can appeal to the lowest common denominator in us to get votes. And I suspect that happens. In some ways, I'm even more mad at National, because I don't think they believe, but they have accepted accepted crap, really, to be in government with people who don't have an understanding of Māori. And that pisses me off even more. People who do know better. Ignorance you can meet with relationship and kindness, but man, when you know and you still bullshit, that pisses me off. Yeah, sorry. That's one way of looking at it, but maybe that was a totem speaking. I don't know.
Well, yeah. You've certainly got the totem with you for sure. Glenn,
sorry for the bad language, Mum.
Thank you so much for
strong language.
Thank you for talking to us today and for singing for us today. It's
no
been
problem.
Absolutely extraordinary to have you here in the studio. So thank you so much for coming in and for being with us. Glenn Cahoon there. Dr. Glenn Cahoon, his two companion books, Myths and Legends of the Ancient Pākehā and Ngā Wahine e Toru Three Women. And also if you go to his website, which you can find the link to on our website, rnz.co.nz/Saturday, you will be able to find the soundtracks as well, which are there.